Welcome everybody to Monday Night Live, Derek Arden's chat show. If you're watching this live, fantastic. Thanks for joining me. And if you're watching this on YouTube, on the podcast, I'm sure you will enjoy it. Tonight I've got Michael Haig with me. And Michael is a Hollywood storyteller, story writer. And to introduce him, I've got my friend from San Francisco, Patricia Fripp, who's going to tell us a little bit about Michael. Over to you, Patricia.
In business, we all need to drive more sales. The best way is to find and deliver emotionally powerful stories. Hollywood knows how to tell a good story. And our connection to Hollywood is Michael Haig. The fastest and most powerful way to add Hollywood principles to our stories is to learn them by listening to Michael Haig and buying his book, Storytelling Made Easy. You're about to learn firsthand Michael Haig's unique approach to story. His principles are based on more than 35 years as one of Hollywood's top script consultants and story experts. Michael has enlightened, entertained, and transformed more than 500,000 writers, filmmakers, speakers, entrepreneurs, and business leaders around the world. In the words of great mega movie star Will Smith, no one is better than Michael Haig at finding what is most authentic in every moment of a story. Derek loves to tell the story of how we met and together negotiated into a strong friendship. Both of us think we got the best deal. How I met Michael Haig is also a fun story. In 2002, I was speaking for the National Speakers Association in Los Angeles. At that time, I was immersed in my segment of my life when I was attending screenwriting classes. Not that I thought I had the talent or the patience to be a screenwriter. However, as we've said, Hollywood knows how to tell a good story. And part of my presentation, I quoted David Freeman, a screenwriting teacher who taught the opening of a movie, and I related it to the opening of a speech as the flavor scene. And then this guy in the fourth row on the end, who had never, ever attended a meeting before, put his hand up and said, "How come you're quoting my competition and not me?" To which I said, "Well, who the heck are you?" We then started attending each other's seminars, became good friends. And 10 years later, when I was going back to speak for NSALA, I said, "Let me recommend you to another speaker." And the program chair said, "Patricia, I won't have to get board approval if you invite him to be part of yours." So that was the first session we did together. It has been my delight to drag Michael from the world of poor romance writers and screenwriters into the slightly more affluent world of entrepreneurs, internet marketers, and speakers. Before I pass over to Derek to ask the first question I made him promise to ask, get your jazz hands ready, which is the Zoom version of a standing ovation, and show Michael how excited we are to be here. Over to you, Derek.
Thank you, Patricia. That was a fantastic introduction. Patricia, what you don't know is that Michael has also negotiated a lift whenever he flies into London with me. He's a pretty top negotiator. I wasn't prepared for it when he negotiated that on Friday night in the rehearsals, but I guess I'm up against two pretty slick negotiators. But I did tell him he would have to be second to you if you're both arriving at the same time. Michael, thanks for joining me. It's an absolute pleasure to have you with us. What everybody wants to know is, how did you meet Will Smith?
Thanks. Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. And Patricia, thanks for the great introduction. I always enjoy hearing that story because that was an example of boldness I don't usually show when I'm a participant in a class. But Patricia, I'll let everybody else know, you have been the conduit to so many introductions for me, not just in podcasts, but also you've introduced me to four former world champion speakers that have all become friends, and I've worked with them. And I shudder to think where my career would be if I hadn't met you and had that one little question, however much that was, 15 years ago or something more than that. So thanks for all of that. I really appreciate it. And as far as one of the very few people that Patricia didn't introduce me to, I'll tell you that story now. And for that story, you have to go back almost exactly 14 years, because it takes place in February of 2007. Now, one evening in that February, I was in my office, the very office you're seeing right now behind me, and it was late in the day, and I was busy doing one of my primary activities throughout my career, and that is staring out the window, just thinking of things. And on this particular night, I was staring out the window and I was kind of feeling sorry for myself. I was a little bit mopey. Now, before I continue, I want to make very clear, I just love what I do. You'll probably realize that once I start talking more, if you don't already. And I've just been blessed because basically for 40 years now, I have earned a living primarily just talking about movies and stories. And so I just love my career, and I've been very lucky and pleased with it. But it doesn't mean I don't get in the dumps once in a while. And so this night I'm looking out the window and I'm thinking about the inner circle. And I'm assuming most of you know what the inner circle is, because there's not an enterprise that I'm aware of that doesn't have it. And that means that whatever arena you're working in, there's always this inner circle of people who have made the pinnacle. They're at the top. They're the ones that everybody knows. They've achieved the sort of highest level of renown or success or whatever in that world. And not only that, they all seem to know and hang out with each other. And I can usually define the inner circle of anything I'm involved with because I'm never in it. And so it's always those people, that we kind of aspire to. And so I'm thinking to myself, as I look out the window, well, I've enjoyed my career so far. I mean, I've gotten to coach people on screenplays. I've worked in Hollywood for a while. I've been involved in some big movies, but I've never really made it into that inner circle. I've never been on the inside the way I'd like to be. And so as I'm sitting there feeling sorry for myself, the phone rings. And so I push the button and say, "Hi, it's Michael Haig." And on the other end, the person says, "Hi, my name's Tracy, and I work with Will Smith." I take her off the speaker and say, "You mean Will Smith, Will Smith?" And she said, "Yeah, that's the one." And she said, "Will is making a movie called I Am Legend up in Canada. They're in production, they're actually shooting the movie, but they're still not quite happy with some of the elements of it. And Will wants to know, would you be willing to take a look at the script and then give him your suggestions and input and reaction and criticisms on that script?" And I paused a few moments for dignity. And then I said, "Yeah, I think I can find the time." So she emails me the script. So I look at the script, I go over it, I read it twice, I take notes. And then I wrote up what must have been a 4-page summary of all of my comments and concerns. And then I emailed it back. And I thought, now this was cool. And I went and told my wife, Vicky, how neat was that? I mean, the biggest movie star in the world wanted to get my input on a movie that he's actually making. And so that was neat. Until about 2 days later, I'm still back in my office, phone rings again, push the button. "Hi, this is Tracy. You may remember I work with," and I said, "Yeah, Will Smith, I remember." And she said, "Well, Will really enjoyed your comments. He really appreciated what you had to say. And he has some ideas of his own about how they might improve the script. And he wants to know, would you be willing to have a conversation with him so he could bounce those ideas off of you and get your reaction? And I too said, yeah, I think I can find the time. So we set up for 2 days later, we were gonna have an evening conversation and I would talk to Will. And I said, well, that's great. But before you go, I gotta ask you something. I said, how does Will even know who I am? I mean, what was it that would have prompted him to contact me to look at the script? And she said, well, I know he's had your book writing screenplays that sell for a long time, but I think the reason he wanted to get in touch in particular is he saw a video you did called The Hero's Two Journeys. And he really liked that. And he really responded, especially where you talked about the difference between our external identity that we present to the world and our inner essence, which we keep hidden out of fear and so on. And especially liked how in a love story, the two people who are each other's destiny have to connect at the level of essence. And I said, cool, that's neat. So we scheduled a meeting. 2 days later, the call is supposed to be at 7 in the evening. So about 6:30, I'm sitting here where you see me, all ready to go. Stupid idea, by the way, because if you're ever nervous about a meeting, the last thing you want to do is be very early, because all you have to do is sit there and worry about it. But I figured I'm good. I've got the script. I've got my notes. I've got my Xanax. I think I'm ready to go. So finally, 7 o'clock, phone rings. It's not Will, because Will doesn't make phone calls for himself. He has people to do that. So Tracy says, hi, I've got Will for you. Will gets on the phone and we have, hi, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you. The little chit chat you do. And I said, look, I know you want to talk about the script, Will, but before we do that, you got to let me do the fan thing for a minute. And he said, okay, because he knew what I meant. And I said, the one thing I want to tell you is Hitch is one of my all-time favorite movies. In fact, I said, I use that script all the time when I'm lecturing to screenwriters, because to me it is the ideal example of what a romantic comedy should be. It hits all of the beats of just a well-written romantic comedy. And he said, well, I should probably tell you that the entire time that we were developing the screenplay for Hitch, we kept asking ourselves, now, are we doing what Michael Haig said we should do and connecting these people at the level of essence? And I thought, I'm in the inner circle.
Wow.
And it remains one of the peak moments in my career. It was also the starting point of something, you know, just very rewarding, because shortly after that, he asked me to give input on his screenplay for Hancock. And then I got to meet him in person when he was shooting the movie at the 20th Century Fox studio. So I met him, and then eventually I got to help him with other scripts and finally got put on retainer by his company to help develop not just his movies, but other movies they were developing. So yeah, that was what I call a good day. And that was my short little moment in the inner circle. So there you are.
Fantastic, Michael. It's funny actually, isn't it, that sometimes when we're at a low, something comes along and a big high comes along just at that point, as you said, staring out the window, feeling a bit gloomy. Now I have to spin the tape back a little bit, because I'd like to know why we need to tell stories, just for the audience. Why do we need to tell stories?
Well, my belief is, or my reason is, that whatever your occupation or whatever you're talking about from the stage or on a Zoom call or whatever situation you're in, we all have basically the same profession. And that is, we're problem solvers. We help people try to solve the problems they face. And to help someone solve their problem, you have to persuade them to do something. You have to get them to follow your advice, to go home and take some action. You want them perhaps to hire you as a coach so you can help them. You might want them to buy a product or a course you've developed. But whatever it is, you need to persuade them to take some action so that they can benefit the guidance you want to give them. And getting someone to take action, getting someone to make a decision to do something new, ultimately that decision is always an emotional decision. I mean, they might tell themselves, I'm doing it for A, B, and C, and you're going to give them data and facts and examples and so on. But primarily, first of all, they want to know, they have to feel good about doing that. And when they hear you present yourself, they want to know, who is this person? And are you an expert? And do you understand me? And do you have a plan for me? Do you know how to solve the problem I'm dealing with? And can I trust you? And can I like you? Do I like you? And the fastest, most powerful way you can get them to say yes to all those questions are through stories, because the primary objective of a story must be to elicit emotion. Stories are a vehicle to get people to feel. And since it's an emotional decision you want them to make, then you have to create a positive emotional experience for them to move them to where they're going to say yes to whatever you want to persuade them to do. And as Patricia mentioned, the world capital of creating emotion is Hollywood. I refer to Hollywood as the emotion picture capital of the world. They know how to do it. And so when you tell a story, and particularly when you tell a story that incorporates the principles and the method that Hollywood's been using for over 100 years now to create an emotional experience, that's when you're going to be most effective at getting people to take action, to persuade them to do whatever it is you want them to do.
Now, you've in Storytelling Made Easy, which I've got here, you talk about a six-step process, and that's a business process, but it's fairly similar to the script process as well. Will you talk us through that?
Sure. Yeah, because as I said from the story, I started out in Hollywood. I came here just to work in the film industry, and what I discovered that was my talent or my passion was the story part of it, working with screenwriters and developing stories and so on. And so in the course of that career, I've developed my own approach to story structure for movies and television series or episodes and so on. And it was that structure was on that video that Will saw. But when, starting with when I met Patricia actually, and then when I got connected to or were approached by internet marketers, and then other business leaders who had heard about me or whatever, I wanted to take that approach, but I wanted to streamline it in such a way that it was not only simpler and more direct and easier in a way, but because when you're telling stories, if you're a speaker or presenter in the business world, you're probably not going to tell, I hope, a story that's 90 minutes to 2 hours long, which is what a movie is. And that was the way I had originally done that. So I pared it down to what I call the six-step success story process. And all that means is when you're telling a story, the hero of that story needs to go through six steps through the course of the story. You need to take them through six steps as they reach the end of their journey. And I'll give you those six steps, but the first thing I want to clarify is when I talk about hero, I'm not talking about someone who's heroic. I'm mostly talking, this is mostly the case in movies as well in speeches you'll be giving, I'm talking about an ordinary person who faces the same feelings, a lot of the same issues and problems and fears and so on that we all do. Now, the hero of your story may become heroic, and that's what the story is about, as they find heroism as they pursue their goal. But just be clear, this is about when you're telling a story about yourself, if it's autobiographical, or someone you've worked with, a successful client, or a mentor you had, or did something that inspired you. we're talking about a hero who's just the main character. If you like the term protagonist, that's fine. So with that character, step one, the first place we need to see that character is what I call the setup. You must introduce the hero of your story living her everyday life before she is thrust into this new situation or this new journey she's going to take. We need to see the before picture of the character. If it's like a story's like a before and after picture, okay? And the before picture is, this is who your hero was yesterday, so to speak, and the day before that and the day before that. So you need to introduce them in their everyday life, but what you want to do there is avoid long backstory. They were born here and they went to school here and that. No, you want to think of a moment as close as possible to them beginning the journey that the story has, and just paint a picture of just very specifically a situation they are in right before that. Let's say the day before, the week before they decide, okay, I've got to go after this new goal. That's the setup. And during that setup, you also have to create empathy with the character, meaning you have to create the necessary psychological connection between the hero of your story and them. And it's just, if you think about any movie you've ever seen, then what really happens is at some point, you're going to forget you're sitting in a movie theater because you're totally inside the story. You're inside the story because you're experiencing it through that character. And so by making your hero, when they are introduced, immediately showing how they are the victim of some undeserved misfortune, so we feel sorry for them, or we worry about them because they're under the threat of some jeopardy, they're about to lose their job or their home or be embarrassed about something, whatever it is they're going to lose, or they're likable, meaning how do they help other people with their problems? How loving and giving and generous are they? By making them sympathetic or in jeopardy or likable, now you've created that necessary empathy. Once you've established that, step two is there has to be a crisis. In other words, there has to be some new event that has never happened to your hero before that is going to force them to take some action. Now, I call it a crisis because oftentimes that event is some, whatever the event is, it's going to, the crisis is they have to figure out, what am I going to do about that? Now, on the face of it, it could be that the crisis is a good news. Let's say you just got an inheritance, let's say, of $100,000. Well, that doesn't sound like a crisis until you realize, what am I going to do with this? You know, are you going to just buy a yacht, or are you going to save it, or are you going to pay off your credit cards, or do you need a financial advisor? But what is it that happens? Now, it might be a negative thing. It might be the point in your career where you lost your job. It might be the tipping point when you had a job and you just, something broke, the straw broke the camel's back. And that's the day that you said, I can't take it anymore. I've got to carve a new path for my life. Or if it's a client, before they called you and asked for your help, something had to happen to move them to that action, because in the setup they're usually tolerating something they that's negative, but they don't want to do anything about it. So what is this event, and how does the hero react to that? Do they make some false starts? Do they take wrong paths? Do they search for answers? They're always going to be looking for the answering the question, what do I do? And in the searching for answers, that's when you'll come into the story if you're not the hero yourself, if it's a client story. Okay, so that's the second thing, the crisis. Once they are exploring this, they're going to decide and declare, okay, in response to this new situation I've been thrown into, this is what I want. This is my goal. And you want that goal to be as clear and visible as possible. It's a finish line that if I ask you about your story, what is your hero's goal? Or what was your goal? The easier it is for me to envision what success will look like, the better the story will be. And in particular, what you want is, if if I were to ask you in front of all 60 people who are here, however many it is, what's the goal? And you tell us, we all get basically the same picture of what success would look like. So a goal where he wants to be healthy is not really, I don't know what that looks like, honestly. It could, or it could look like 100 things. But if it's about someone who wants to run and complete a marathon because they're out of shape to begin with, now we all know what that looks like. There's literally a finish line. So with that goal, now step three is, because that was all part of the crisis, step three is pursuit. And step four is conflict, meaning in the middle of the story, the hero is now going after that goal. And these are the steps your hero has to take. This is what you had to do to achieve the goal you're talking about. And step four is the conflict. That's the obstacles you face or you faced when you were pursuing that goal. What made it hard? And the reason that's critical is because, remember, your primary goal is to elicit emotion. Emotion grows out of conflict. It's the obstacles in the story that create the emotional experience for us. That's when we as the audience lean into it. It's not the goal. The goal just drives the story forward. It's what does the hero have to overcome to achieve it? And those could be obstacles external, you know, like getting in shape, don't know how to run a marathon or whatever, but also there could be the inner conflict. What I mentioned that Will was taken with in the lecture he saw, that inner journey. That means what scared you about doing this? What were the fears that held your hero back from doing this? So there's both those kinds of conflict. So pursuit and conflict until finally you reach step five, which is the climax. That's simply the moment where the hero crosses the finish line. That's the moment which must resolve the goal. Now, occasionally in a story, it'll be a failure story and the hero fails to achieve the goal, or you didn't reach the goal, but you learned a life lesson. But whether you won or lost, whether you crossed the finish line or not, it has to be resolved at that moment. And if it's a successful ending, if it's a happy ending, you can't just say, and they made the $100,000 and now they're happy. That doesn't work. We want to enjoy, because we've become this character. We want to celebrate that. We want the emotional experience. So what was it like at that moment when you realized I did it? I accomplished my goal. And then finally, when the goal is resolved, the story can't be over. You have to add step six, which is what I call the aftermath. And this is where the persuasive part of your story comes more than any. And the aftermath is the new life that your hero is now living because they completed that journey. And when you're telling a story for business, where you're trying to persuade someone to take some action, you want to be sure in that story that the aftermath for the hero of the story is the life that your audience or your prospect dreams of. They've got to, because now you've made your audience or your reader, if you're writing a nonfiction book or if it's a webinar or whatever, your audience is now identified with this character and you've given them the emotional experience of winning. Now you want to give them the emotional experience of actually having the life that they dream of. Now, it doesn't mean if your hero ended up getting a new beach house that they all want that. But if your audience would love freedom and wealth, okay, and independence, then that becomes a great aftermath because they want the life that your hero does. Or maybe they want good health, or maybe they want to overcome some bad habit. But whatever it is they want deep down, that's what you want the aftermath to be. And that's it. It practically writes itself. I don't want to make it sound too easy, but I absolutely guarantee, if you tell a story that hits all those six steps, you're going to project yourself into the top 10% of anybody out there telling the story. I absolutely promise.
Fantastic. Now, do you want me to put that up on the screen, that six-step process, Michael?
Yeah, I'm just putting it in the chat box. If you'd like to see this in left brain form, I've created a chart. Are you, There we go. This is a chart. You don't try and read it all now because it's too detailed, but I these are the six steps along with some information about each one so you can identify exactly how does this work in more detail than I was able to give you. And if you would like a copy of this chart, you can download this by just going to this link. And it's in the chat room. I don't know if the chat room shows, but it's at the very top of the chat room. It's basically storymastery.com. That's my website at the bottom of the chart, /success. So if you go to that link and then click, yes, I'd like my chart, then it will capture your email and then you'll get an email right away that you can download this. And there you'll have it. And so I don't have to railroad through it like I just did the explanation, but this will be, this should be a good help in being able to apply this to your stories.
Fabulous. Now, what I'm trying to get my head around is there any difference between a movie story and a business story?
Yeah, the story itself, essentially, no. Go to any movie, think of any movie you really like, and I guarantee the hero went through those six steps. The key difference is in the objective, okay? So if you're a professional writer, let's say you're a screenwriter, a filmmaker, a production company, or a studio, or whatever, their goal is to get you to pay money, get the audience to pay money directly. I want to pay for this story. But for your stories in business, I don't know how to break it to you, but you're not going to make a dime on your story. No one's going to pay you for your story. But as I like to say sometimes, no one is going to pay you for this either. Okay? But you wouldn't go without it because it's the tool that you use to communicate with people in the hopes that they will connect with you and pay you or hire you to get your help. Well, that's all a story is. It's a communication device to persuade people that they want to work with you. So the way you make money off a story is not by the story itself. It's the vehicle to get them to say yes. So you will make money off of the service they hire you to give. Or if you're a public speaker, It's the good stories you tell and the way you touch the audience that's also going to get other speaker bureaus or other conferences or other people to want to pay you for your speech, for your speeches. Now, the speech is more than it's just a story. The stories populate the overall speech because by creating emotion through the story, then you can go into the data, I call it, the elements of what it is. So Patricia, who, as you know, we've known each other a long time, but this is what Patricia's brilliant at. I mean, she tells stories when she is instructing people on how to give great presentations so that they will illustrate what she wants. And then she says, and here are the steps to giving a great presentation. But that's because it's enhanced because she has captured the emotion of her audience more strongly through the story she's telling.
Now, I tell a lot of negotiation stories, but I'm very conscious that they're the ones that I've captured. So over the last 30 years, I've captured every negotiation I've been in. I have records of them, but I feel a bit conscious, particularly in Britain, perhaps, of telling stories that where I was successful or where I've not been successful. Is that just my British reserved nature or should I keep telling them?
Okay, well, it may be your British nature, but it doesn't mean Americans don't have the same worry. I mean, one of the major objections that I hear or the main resistance I get when I tell people it's important to tell stories for business, it doesn't matter which side of the pond they're on or where in the world they are. It's the statement is usually is, I don't want to just get up there and brag, okay? I don't want to just be saying, I don't want people to think it's all about me, me, me. So that's the way you avoid that. If you tell the story wrong, That could be the case. What people do not want is to have a speaker or a presenter, or, you know, when you're writing your book, we don't generally enjoy people getting up and starting with basically, I'm a multimillionaire and I only wish that you could be as good as I am so you could reach the pinnacle I've reached. Generally speaking, we don't like that. Now it's not like it can't work. I suppose if somebody was a famous multimillionaire and they were full of themselves, I'd still want to know how did you do it. But then we're not going to connect with those people. But what stories are is what I refer to as stealth marketing. In other words, you're not really tooting your own horn in the same way. Or you're not really directly saying, please give me money, please give me money. What you're doing is telling a story about yourself where in the setup, you create that empathy. You are not someone who is already heroic. You're not someone who's already a big success. Or even if you were a success, you're someone who still had fears or problems or issues that you needed to overcome. Because then when you begin the story, we will identify with the struggle you have. We'll identify with those fears. We'll identify with these emotions you're experiencing. And then you will take us on the journey that you went on to solve your problem. So now remember, we have become you psychologically. So by the time you get to the moment of big success, we feel successful, number one, and we want to celebrate it with you. And so you've still gotten across the idea that you have something to offer because you were very successful at doing that, okay? But we feel the success for ourselves more if you start where you were struggling and then you get us to the moment of victory. And it's the same and equally valuable means of stealth marketing is to tell stories about people you have guided. If you're a consultant, people you have, you know, coached. If you're an author, people who have followed your advice in your book. If you're whatever it is, if you have a product you market, an online course or, you know, a beauty product or a health supplement or whatever it might be. Because now you want your audience to identify with the people who've used your product and found success with that. And you don't need to worry that if you're not the hero, you're in the story because you're going to guide them, or your product is in the story because that's what they will use to get healthy. But you don't need to worry that they're going to think, well, if this story isn't about me, why would they give me money? No, they're going to have the emotional experience of working with you through the hero of your story. And so you've actually given them a taste test of what it's like to succeed with your guidance or with your product. So if you tell the story in that way, you don't need to worry about being too big for your britches, as my mother used to say, because we will see, that's how we feel like you get us, if we're in the audience, that you understand what our problems are because you had similar fears at the start of your story. Does that make sense, Darren?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you. You use the word stealth marketing. That isn't a term that I've heard before.
Good, because I made that one up. Oh. I don't coin too many phrases, but I was happy with that one. So cool. And now you can use it. Now you can spread it around.
I love that. I love that.
There's a few... put that little registered thing next to it. No.
Yeah, I will, as we say, I'll borrow that one with your permission, sir. Thank you.
Absolutely. You all have my permission to use it.
Yeah. There's some questions in the chat box.
Okay.
If I can go to the chat box. Here's one that I'd thought of as well from Kevin O'Connor in Chicago. He says, can you go to a movie as a professional storyteller and just enjoy it, or are you analyzing everything that happens?
Yeah, the answer is absolutely yes. I've been getting that question for a long, long time, but the reason I do what I do, the whole reason I came to Hollywood is I just love movies, and I'm not about to ruin the movie by sitting there with my chart and saying, uh-oh, they just encountered the crisis. No, I just get lost in the movie. The only time I ever find myself, there's only two occasions where I analyze. One, I see it a second or third time. So because now I've had the emotional experience and I've been surprised and I've been involved and I've rooted for the hero, and now I want to go back and see how it works. The other occasion would be if the movie's really bad, because then I'm bored and and then the only fun I have is saying, yep, didn't follow that advice, didn't follow that. Or usually, you know, this is when I can't be too big for my britches because I'm alone watching TV, but I'll say, geez, they should have taken my class. If they had read my book, they wouldn't have made this mistake. But other than those two times, no, I just love the movie. I react in whatever way anybody else will.
I think you've answered the question. Any cautions for the hero being the storyteller? I think we just have to tell the emotions that we went through at the time and how we were really struggling.
Yeah. Yeah. Start right before you encountered a crisis that forced you to take action. And try not to make it an epic story, your epic life story. That's not really one that's going to help you much because it's too much information. We focus on particular goals you had and particular successes you had and tell the story of how you accomplished that particular win.
Now, a couple of people want to know at which point you bring up fees, Michael. I'm sorry to raise this, but you have Will, you know, you have Will Smith on the phone. And at which point do you say that'll be $100,000 for that piece of information?
Well, here's the scenario I am, Derek. When I talked to Will, I never brought up fees. I just said, you know, I'll send him a bill. You know, the guy's richer than God. Is he gonna quibble? Because I, you know, charge a few hundred dollars an hour. So I, you know, now you're out of my bailiwick. See, I'm a one-trick pony. I know about stories. When you get into fees, you and Patricia should be answering that question because you're versed at that. I'm more like I was trying to get a date for the prom, you know. You wouldn't want to go to the dance with me, would you? So I'm not a good model for how you do that. How would you say, Derek? I mean, or Patricia could unmute her. I mean, you guys use stories and then you have to move into the fee state. Do you have any suggestion for that question?
Well, I'm thinking all the time how much I can ask them for. So I put people into three categories. The people that can't pay that I'm going to work with anyway, the sort of middle of the road charity sector. And then how much can I get from this, really? And I don't mean to sound greedy, but what can I say my normal fee is for 30 years of experience, negotiation expertise, and studying the subject all over the world? So that's a tricky one at that point. And there's one or two speakers on here that we're like Will, who we share how we do it. And to be honest, the answer's different every time, really. But you know, if Will Smith called me, I'd be struggling for an answer. But
Patricia, I've heard her hand up.
Well, one with someone like Will Smith, I don't think it's appropriate, because you know. But my question would be: would you charge Will Smith and say Patricia Fripp or any of our audience members the same fee?
Well,
that's a tricky question, Michael. Yeah. You don't have to actually.
We all struggle with this.
Mm. If you go back to the story, my belief was I worked on an hourly basis and I charged him the same hourly basis because it wouldn't have seemed right to say, well, you're rich, I'm going to charge you more per hour for the same thing. And actually, I didn't work with Will any differently than I would work with anybody else on their story. I would still sit down, ask questions, hear about the story or read the script, and then start asking questions. If I were negotiating a flat fee, then I would, which I do more now, part of the consideration is what is the value of what we're going to do to you? Because if I'm coaching someone on a webinar that stands a good chance of making $1 million, then I could take that into consideration. But again, I'm so not the expert in that. The one thing I might say on linking it to story is, first of all, I can't think of any situation where you'd want to mention your fees and then say, and now let me tell you a story that proves I'm worth it. You start with the story. Then you need to link the story to, you need to tell the story and then link the message of that story to the problems that the people you're addressing or your prospects are dealing with. And the lesson grows out of that aftermath. It's like, or another way to say it is, whatever your hero in the story learns, that they learn in order to succeed, that's what you're trying to teach the people in your audience. That's what they're trying to teach your prospect. So if they learn not only that they needed to work with you, but that the key to negotiation is getting them, this is one of the simple things, but I got it off one of your videos, Derek, if one of the keys is don't mention numbers first, okay, then you want to tell a story. If that's something that's important to your prospect, then tell a story about someone who either made the mistake and lost, and then tell a second story about how they corrected that, or tell a story about how they were shrewd because they knew enough to get the press, their prospect to mention money first, or whatever the principle is. So it's like, here's the story, the hero learned something, and so now I want to talk more about what they learned and why that's important to you. And then you can get to, and why you will learn a lot more about that by working with me or using my product. And now let's talk about how much value that is to you. So I think the negotiation, the fee is going to come after the story, after the content, and more well into the presentation.
Absolutely. I'd think even further down the track than that, you want them hooked in, wanting to use you before you start talking about fees, don't you? So it's once you've done the benefits. Another question in the chat box is, can storytelling transcend into report writing or presenting to project stakeholders? I think the question is in writing. We know that, so that we tell stories when we're pitching or presenting to a client, but what about in a report?
Well, it seems to me depend. I mean, I'm by no means versed in report writing because it's not really something that's done in my world, either in Hollywood or in coaching people on story. But it seems to me there are sometimes the reports are just charts and graphs and data, and that's what they want. And I don't know that would, you know, help. But I have a client right now who's high-level consultant to just huge corporations, and especially about leadership and so on. And he's one of the most, you know, he's like a scientist. He's created all these models and so on. But the reason he's working with me is so he can both humanize and, for want of a better term, dumb down all the math and science in such a way that the people who, you know, hire the company don't care. I mean, you know, if it's scientists talking to scientists, they talk that language, but usually the person who's going to write the check or okay the job doesn't know that. And so if it's strictly a report, I don't know. You'd have to look at successful reports and say, were there any stories? But as soon as you're trying to persuade somebody to take action in response to the report, then, and especially if you know that they're not easily going to understand all the minutiae of the report, then I would say, yeah, here's a story about someone who was helped by whatever it is. Now, here's all the data that goes along with that.
Okay.
So that's my guess, but again, it's not my arena, reports, but I also my passion is stories. So I say, if you can put a story in it, put it in, but that doesn't necessarily work in all cases.
Michael, we're beginning to run out of time, but we've got some more questions in the chat box. Can I just ask you, how do people get your book that are watching this? Is it available on Amazon?
It's available on Amazon or with that chart, the website that's on the bottom of the chart that you're going to with the slash success if you take away the slash and go to my website, it has an abundance of free articles and videos and so on about storytelling. And there's also a list of the various products I have. And you can purchase either the paper version of the book or the digital version of the book there. So either one, or it's Amazon, any bookstore is going to.
Yeah, I guess I got it from amazon.co.uk. So I know it's available here. Okay, I'm going to fire these three questions for you quite quickly. We talked about the crown, didn't we, in the rehearsal? And Mike Roberts asks, is there a storyteller's ethical code regarding attributing fictional dialogue or fictional scenes to historical characters or real life events without the consent? I guess they're talking about the royal family there.
Okay, as far as a code is concerned, that's sort of your judgment about what you consider moral and not. But what you need is a lawyer. Now, if you're putting words in the mouths of, you know, people in Elizabethan England, I think you're pretty safe. You know, there's no, but it, you know, and I have no idea how they did the crown, because in America, the general principle is if they're public figures and you have research that reveals these things and you can do it, so they can't say, well, you know, you're invading my privacy, that's it. But yeah, but as soon as you start asking that question, unless you get permission from someone. I mean, I have testimonials and tell stories about a lot of clients, but I would never do that without saying, it's okay with you if I talk about this.
Okay. Do you have any tips for creating a title for the story here from Lorraine?
Keep it, business story might be slightly similar, but here's the Hollywood principle. If you look at Hollywood movies, number one, short. Number two, memorable. Number three, either the title makes it clear what the emotion is or what the story is about, or it's intriguing enough that we will want to know, what does that mean? Why would we want to go to that movie? So, Jaws, you wouldn't have known what it was, but as soon as you see the picture of the shark about to swallow up that woman swimming, then you're there. For business related stories, I think it's still the same thing. It's like you want to create the promise of emotion. Okay. So if they read the title and say, yeah, I need to know about that, and they start thinking, I'd feel much better subconsciously if I did that, then make it that clear. But if it sounds like, hey, this is intriguing, what could this be about? And that creates curiosity, and then they find out, and that's emotional, then that's it. It's a very tough one to say a hard and fast rule for, even in Hollywood, but with business story, the same thing. But whichever you do, make it succinct. You know, two, three words, you know, not a sentence, you know, just as easy. First of all, also, you want it just a few words, so when you put it on the internet, it'll show up. Yeah. So that'd probably be the main thing.
Keywords, and Patricia's very good at writing headlines as well, which of course is the headline that attracts people to blogs and to Twitter and everything else. Last question, Michael.
Now that I think about it, let me add one more thing. Emotion grows out of conflict. So pinpoint in the title the conflict, the problem that whatever you're writing about needs to be solved. Make sure that's in there, more than just this is about this situation. Immediately, if you can make the title something that says, wow, that sounds like a problem, or that's something I have to deal with, that'll be stronger.
And the final question for you, and I hope you'll stay on afterwards, after we've closed the recording down, for the people that still have time, what's your favorite movie?
Well, don't end with that. That's an impossible question to answer, because I, you know, how many thousand movies have I watched? And there's so many, it depends on what I remember that day. So let's see if I can. Okay, here's one. I'm going to recommend a movie you may not have heard of, that I've never recommended this movie to anybody and they didn't end up really loving it, but you might not know about it. It's called Lars and the Real Girl. L-A-R-S, Lars and the Real Girl. And the reason it wasn't real successful at the box office, even though the script was nominated for an Oscar, is because it's when you if you read the one-liner, it's going to sound like something you won't want to see. But trust me, it's just a beautiful movie. It follows all of my steps also as a great example of a romantic comedy, but it's also touching and so on. Now, that's one of many favorites, but it's the first one that came to mind because it's one I often recommend when people haven't, because a lot of people haven't seen it. And I'd rather turn you on to something that you'll enjoy. So sure. Trust me on that. I haven't lied to you yet. If you don't like it, I'm out of here. You know, you can take your complaint to Derek. It's his fault for having me on the show, but look for that.
Michael, that's been absolutely fantastic. Now, well, we both like negotiating, don't we? So I've still got a whole list of questions that I wanted to ask you, but we've run out of time. So if I ask you really nicely, will you come back on the show later on in the year?
Sure. Now, I've already got the free ride whenever I come to England, so I may ask for something different, but I'll think about it.
Okay, well, I want to learn about the story of the Beverly Wiltshire, because I know Vicky, your wife, knows the hotel manager or the actor that played the hotel manager in the Beverly Wiltshire in Pretty Woman. And yeah. I'm a massive fan of Pretty Woman and Julia Roberts. So I want to hear that story when we invite you back.
Okay, I promise. I'd love to come back and I'll stick around now for sure.
Fantastic. Well, Michael Haig, thank you so much for
thank you all.
Patricia, thank you for introducing Michael and introducing me to Michael, and a huge round of applause in the usual way for Michael Haig.
Well, thank you guys as well.